basically.
Oh yeah, there are two more containers.
These are for microphones. These are for like the wired microphones. But this is exactly the same as it was.
You would just put
it down and just hold off.
Yeah. Turned off that and volume, because sometimes
the wireless microphone is fixed right now, so it's got a fixed loud volume.
Okay.
So you can make it louder or quieter by depending on where you are. No, these all control the. And if you were showing a DVD or playing audio through your laptop, you would control that. You don't need the audio if you want to. If you wanted to play music through your laptop, you could do that.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, you definitely can. This is already on the table. You would just plug that in. You can adjust that volume. But on the day you can do that. When you're wearing it, you have a little shoe.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, the first year when Teddy got like this, students said
they're better. The headsets are better than the whole time.
Okay. So if I want to go down a little bit, I should bring it down like that.
Okay, that's good.
So when I want to really scream, I can bring it. Okay, good. So that's better. Thank you. Okay, it's about giving the time. Okay, good. This one was in my office, I believe. This one was here on the exam today. So erasers claim it. I don't like all these gifts. So here they are. Whosoever it is, please claim it. There. All right. Let's go continue with the upper extremity. Axilla, that is where we were. We were finishing up the contents of the axilla, So there, what I need to do a little bit more is that you've done the brachial plexus. Now, after the brachial plexus, there's some clinical conditions that I like to go over in class. All right. Okay, so here we have the brachial plexus, and we have looked at how it is formed what are the chords and what structures you will see in the in this quarter, and what structures or what parts of the brachial plexus will be seen in the third quarter. So we have gone over those, and now the clinical conditions, some clinical conditions, because some of these are, you know, very important, because you may come across these clinical conditions periodically, you know, childbirth and, you know, all kinds of, you know, traumas and things like that, you know, these clinical conditions are. You know, now, how is it related to the brachial plexus? That's where I'm going to take you through, so that, you know, if you come across something, you can improve upon it, you know, things will be, you know, improved and added and all that. Before I go any further, no tutorial today. I will not be holding a tutorial today. You want me to go and vote, don't you?
Yeah.
Yes, yes. So I don't want to be, you know, stand away, because, you know, the lineup I hear, you know, is very long. So I may leave the campus around 3 o'clock or somewhere there I may leave. So if you have any questions you want that cannot wait till Thursday's tutorial, please come to my office between 2 and 3, and I will be happy, you know, to help you with the questions. But 3 o'clock I'm leaving, because I want to make sure. All right. And so then the other is, most people did reasonably well in the living anatomy test, yes, exam yesterday. There may be 4 or 5 people who did not pass. But when I say they did not pass, you know, it is still very possible for them to pass. If they even got 60%, they can pass, because what they need to get is 100%. You know, on the final exam, so 100 plus 60, 160 divided by 2 is 80%, and so 80% is passed for living anatomy. So most people have passed it, maybe 4 or 5 at the most is less than 80%. And so I will not, you know, worry about it, and I think all those scores that I've seen, you know, you can make it up. 77, 78, 75, 70, you know, I think that is the lowest. From that you can make up with the final, you know, on the living anatomy. And so that's how it goes. And so, generally speaking, I was kind of pleased with the general performance of the class in living anatomy. I don't know about the others yet, but I don't think I'm too happy when I heard about the reception deal. All right. Okay, so let me move on. You didn't hear anything from me. Now, theory, I don't know yet, because, you know, we have the fill in the blank and short answer, you know, component there, okay? And so as soon as I have that, what's the matter? No? Okay, let's move on. Why do you speak when I start? Why don't you say the answer?
Well, now we're all worried about the gross exam.
You should not, because I did not see anything, I did not hear anything. The three monkeys, they don't see, they don't hear, they don't speak, isn't it? Yeah, so that's the three monkeys all in one. No, so, you know, I have a big mouth, you know that, most of the times, and I should test, I don't keep it shut most of the times, but that's what happens. All right, so clinical conditions, Erb Duchenne paralysis, some of them are in the blue boxes, but I still like to take you through this, because I really consider the mammary gland and, you know, the lymph nodes and, you know, this the brachial plexus, you know, very important, you know, structures, you know, and so therefore, one of the conditions is Erb Duchenne paralysis. Erb Duchenne paralysis is like this. Erb. Okay, here. Okay, Erb Duchenne paralysis results from, you know, excessive, in infants, it can result from excessive pulling on the infant's, you know, infant's arms during delivery. And this is why I go over it here, because some of you will be taking midwifery, you know, sometime after, you know, the fourth year or something like that. So what happens is, Erb Duchenne paralysis means this point here, the Erb's point, this point here, where C5 and C6 come unite to form what trunk is formed here? This one. The upper trunk. I went over this. I drew it with you the other day. And so this point here is the earth's point. It's here. Earth's point here, okay? So that earth's point, okay? From earth's point, there are nerves arising. And that we went over also. And so you can see suprascapular nerve. And you can also see nerve to subclavius, C5, C6. And so if excessive pulling on the infant's arm during childbirth, you know, tears this, you know, trunk here, this part here, or it is really damaged extensively, then the nerves that are coming from here, that means, you know, the subscapular, that means which is this one here, yeah, suprascapular and nerve to subclavius. The C5 and C6, you saw the other day, see how these nerves are formed. When these nerves are formed, see C5 and 6, C5, 6, C5, 6, C5, 6, see, you find these fibers in so many nerves. And now, here, and those nerves, like the subclavius and suprascapular, those nerves innervate a lot of muscles in this region. Deltoid, your biceps brachii, your coracobrachialis, and supraspinatus, infraspinatus, a whole lot of those muscles receive innervations from nerves that contain fibers that are coming from C5 and C6. So if these fibers are affected, damaged, have lesions, torn, you know, or, you know, whatever damage happens, the muscles that receive innervations from these nerves are going to be not able to do what they are normally supposed to do. And deltoid muscle, what is the main action of the deltoid? It has three groups of fibers, abduction, which you already showed me, abduction. Abduction is the main action, even though it can do flexion, extension, you know, all kinds of things it can do, but all three fibers participate in the formation in this action, abduction. So abduction is going to be affected. So if abduction is going to be affected, how is this arm going to be? If abduction, if the arm cannot abduct, how is it going to be? Adducted. And biceps brachii muscle, what is its function? Biceps brachii. Flexion of the forearm and? Supination. Flexion of the forearm and supination. So then what is the forearm going to do? Pronated and extended at the elbow. Extended at the elbow and pronated. And so then that is what the textbook Blue Boxes is talking about, weightage tip position. Weightage tip position is this position of the arm. So you can see weightage tip in classy restaurants. You know, they don't put it on, you know, these waiters, you know, they have the towel like that on their hand, and then they have their hand like this, you see? So this is where, you know, this is olden times, this is where you put the tip in this hand. That is what is called the waiter's tip position. That is what is, Dr. Moore is explaining that, okay? Waiter's tip position. That means the arm is adducted. Elbow is, you know, extended, and the forearm is pronated, because, you know, all those muscles that carry out these actions are not able to do the normal function. And so when you have delivered a child, on the third day, fifth day, the mother tells you, no, my child will not lift this arm. The arm is like this, is sitting next to the body and things like that. You want to think, you know, if you delivered or somebody else delivered, if there's any damage to the upper trunk. And so that is erg, dushing, paralysis. Okay, that is one of them. And another one is, you know, where you have what is called trunky paralysis. That textbook explains, you know, very nicely. Oh, this abduction paralysis, not only it can happen in infants, but it can also happen in adults with some injuries, you know, like where the neck is, you know, really forcefully separated like that from the shoulder, you know, from here. That means, you know, if you had an injury, you know, with the shoulder, you know, forceful injury, you know, where the neck is separated. I don't mean physically torn off, but, you know, forcefully separated. It can also affect, it can have the same effect, the same, you know, condition, the same paralysis. And then we have, you know, another one called trunky. Clunky, or, you know, clunkies, you know, when you are, you know, saying it like that, clunkies paralysis. This is kind of a partial paralysis, not full. I'll take you through that also. Here what happens is, in clunky paralysis, what is affected here is the inferior or the lower trunk. So here you can see the inferior or the lower trunk, what is forming there, C8 and G1, you know, here you have the inferior, you know, or the lower trunk. And so if that is torn or that is damaged, what happens is the nerves that are coming out of this, you know, this cord here, the medial cord here, you have the ulnar nerve and you have the median nerve, both of them have C8 and G1. So ulnar nerve, we haven't studied yet, goes and innervates a lot of the intrinsic muscles of the hand. So flexing, you know, so when the flexors of the hand are affected here, of the hand, I'm not talking about the whole upper extremity, I'm talking about the hand. And so that can, the flexors can be like this. That is the effect called the claw hand. So if in case of clunky paralysis, it is a partial paralysis and it affects, you know, the intrinsic muscles of the hand. And the trunk that is affected there is the lower or the inferior, you know, trunk of the brachial plexus, inferior trunk of the brachial plexus, okay? And so that is claw hand, just as it sounds. And when you look at the coloring packet I gave you the other day, I have some, this was actually more or less for the whole upper extremity that I gave you this coloring packet here. You can see the claw hand in some place here. See here, you can see there are all these things are here. Claw hand with median nerve, I mean with ulnar nerve, median nerve, all of those things are in here. Not only we colored this one, I colored this one with you the other day. You know, the anastomosis, yes.
Does this affect the growth of the arm?
Pardon me?
The growth of the arm.
The growth
so
of the arm?
The growth of the arm, I see it gets bigger. Like how big the arm gets?
No, it should not. The question was, does this affect the growth of the arm? It should not affect the growth of the arm because the skeletal development, the muscular development, the skeletal development, protein synthesis is especially, you know, with your, what is called your level of thyroxine during the embryonic period and all that. So the growth per se in height, you know, and other, you know, ways, it should not affect. Because this is only a trunk or a nerve that where it is innovating, which structures, you know, being innovated. Yes, yes, Sarah, Fatima. Yes, Stavis, okay. Yeah. Yes, those of you who are not here, I'm not going to bring it to you. I'm going to leave it here. You take it or leave it. And so, and about half the class is not here. And so you haven't heard my famous saying about that. You have heard from other people. Some of you heard it. Let me tell you. When you miss a class, biochemistry, anatomy, physiology, whatever, to study for an exam, even though you had total Wednesday to study, you're borrowing from John to pay Simon. John is still at your doorstep with your debt, with his debt. So you're borrowing from John to pay Simon. Simon will be happy, but John will not be. So keep in mind, I'm not, so that the information that we went over, because I'm not going to hold off or repeat things that I have done in gross anatomy that last day whenever it was, okay? So it's up to you to get the information. And so please understand that. So whether it is biochemistry or anatomy, if you think I stay away from one class 2 hours or 3 hours, how much are you going? You worry some. Some time will be, some energy will be lost in worries. And so anyways, that is where if you didn't get it, let's move on to, so that is clunky paralysis. And in addition, we also have some others, cervical rib, what I call, you know, cervical rib. Cervical rib is not really a rib per se. So that was number two here. Number one and number three, cervical rib. Cervical rib is when you have the transverse process of C7, transverse process. Enlarges and acts like a rib. And so what can happen is, this is the first rib, right here. And so here you have the C7. And so if this transverse process, you know, enlarges and comes much like a, you know, rib right here, that never has a good diagram of this. I don't have it, you know, with this, what do you call, you know, with this CD, but never has a good diagram shows you the cervical rib. They don't call it the cervical rib, but you can see the diagram. And so there, what will happen is, if it enlarges here, so you have a transverse process coming like that, the first rib is here, so then again, the inferior or the lower trunk is going to be pinned between the cervical rib and the first rib. And so you will have, you know, some, you know, pressure symptoms. So if you're pinning, if you are compressing the lower trunk, right here, the lower trunk or the inferior trunk right here, then some pressure symptoms. What pressure symptoms do you expect? When you say pressure symptoms, what will your patient tell you? So the upper extremity, yeah, numbness, tingling, you know, some pain maybe, some of these unnatural, you know, feelings that they will complain to you about. Pressure symptoms, like your leg goes off to sleep when you are sitting and taking the exam, you forget everything, you are paying attention to the questions, your leg may go off to sleep. And so similarly, that kind of feelings and tingling and few other things can happen in cervical rib. Yes? That is because of your compressing. You know, the cervical rib, that means if you have an enlarged transverse process of C7 coming down here, which normally should not be there. Why is it happening? I don't know. It happens. Tell me. Some people may have the problem. The question is, are you born with that? There may be a very few percentage, very, very few percentage of people, infants may be born with it and may develop during childhood when the ribs are... How are the ribs? Wait, I saw your hand. I'll come to your question in a minute. How are the ribs developed? Normally, how do the ribs develop? I mean, not the, biblical story of taking it, you know, from the, you know. So how are it has how are the ribs developed? From the transmit processes only. Normally the ribs are developing from the transmit processes off, but the thoracic vertebrae, not the cervical. Ribs develop from the transverse processes of the thoracic vertebrae, that is normal. But for some reason, unknown to me, for some reason, the C7, its transverse process also may enlarge and try to become like a rib, where it should not be. And so if that happens, then you have two bony, you know, what do you call structures here, the first rib, where it should be, and then the cervical rib. And so it's growing right over here. And so between these two structures, the lower trunk or the inferior trunk will be compressed. And so resulting in, you know, compression symptoms in the upper extremity. Your question?
Is this the same sort of thing as like thoracic outlet syndrome?
Is it the same thing as the thoracic outlet syndrome? Pretty close, yeah. When we do the thorax, we will go there. Somebody else had, yeah. I don't know your, I don't recall your name. Fitzpatrick, okay, yeah, okay.
You're saying that the first rib and the
first rib is always there. First rib we all get. And then from C7 the transverse process enlarges, where it should not enlarge, where it should stay, you know, as a transverse process. And the textbook also goes into the details. If you want more details, please read the textbook because I have to move on. Yes.
Is that palpable? Would you see it?
Is it palpable? I don't know. I really don't know whether it is palpable or not. You know, you may be able to. I have seen double sets of ribs.
Uh-huh.
That I don't know. On a cadaver. Two sets. One rib on top of the other. I did not know how that person was breathing. Yes. Yes, it's old, in the old school I have. It most probably, if it is here, it should be. It's a bony structure, it should be palpable. I never thought of it. That's why I said I don't know. But it should be palpable. You know, above and here. I mean, the lower trunk of the brachial plexus is about here. Because the brachial plexus, you know, it is right here. Between your, what do you call, the scalenus anterior muscle, scalenus medius muscle, right here. Okay, so it should be palpable. Thank you for that question. So her question was, is that, you know, cervical rib palpable? That was her question. And so then we have this one with phrenic nerve. Phrenic nerve is another thing. Again, these are all clinical things. I like to go over a little bit of these things with you. That is the phrenic nerve. Normally, phrenic nerve has spinal roots C4, sometimes get some contribution from C5. It may also get a contribution from C3. Only contribution, okay? This is contribution, and most of the fibers of the phrenic nerve comes from C4. But as you look at it, you don't see the phrenic nerve is here. See here? Here's the phrenic nerve. You can see there is C4 contributing, and it will get some from C5. So in case of phrenic nerve, again, it's a clinical thing that you may want to have heard somewhere, sometime. That is what I'm taking you there. And that is, if for some reason, if somebody wants to stabilize a lung, that means they don't want that lung to be expanding and doing its actions, want to rest, you know, part of a lung or a lung for whatever reason. There are so many reasons, I cannot go into any of them. And so here, and so they may, what they do is they crush the phrenic nerves as they come down, because the phrenic nerves come down here like that, and they go to the diaphragm. They go to the diaphragm because they also have some function there, and so they, you know, give, you know, so they are stabilizing that part of the diaphragm here because they are innervating the diaphragm, the phrenic nerve diaphragm, okay? So right and left. And so if they don't want one part of the lung or one lung, you know, to move up and down, that means to stabilize, then they have to have the diaphragm stabilized. because it's the diaphragm breathing, you know, when you're breathing in and breathing out, it's the diaphragm that is, you know, also causing, you know, the lungs, you know, to go up and down with it. And so when they crush one of them, what can happen is, if it has a large contribution from C5, and they will not be going and crushing C5, because look, all the nerves, almost all the nerves of the upper extremity have C5 fibers in it. So you don't want to crush C5. So they may go and crush C4. But if the phrenic nerve has a large contribution from C5, you can crush C4 fibers, but the effect that is desired will not happen. Because there is a large contribution from C5, as opposed to should only be a small contribution. So then, this again, as a physician, you will be working with people who are doing these things, or you will get patients who have had such, you know, things done, or you may want to be aware, you know, what happens when something like phrenic crush is done, you know. So, but the person, you know, it's not getting better. So you may want to think about some of these things. Yes, Jesse?
Did you say if you crush the phrenic nerve and it has a large contribution from C5, it won't?
Phrenic nerve, because it has most of its fibers should come from C4. So when they are crushing the phrenic nerve, that means the C4 contribution they are crushing. Okay? And they are not crushing C5. All right. That's what it means. Large. If the contribution from C5 is large, unless they go and crush C5, which they don't, because of its contribution to so many nerves in their proximity, and they may have to do something else, phrenic avulsion or something like that, that means, you know, tearing it off or this or that, I don't know. They do all kinds of surgical things, yes.
Is that permanent?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Is that permanent, or is it just like pinching it off?
Pinching it off, it's not permanent. It's not. Her question was, is it permanent? No, because the peripheral nerves have the ability to regenerate. Peripheral nerves have the ability to regenerate. And it is the central nerves, or the central nerve system, that people thought, you know, do not have the ability to regenerate. But that's not the case anymore. It is, research shows that there is a regeneration taking place, even mitotic division taking place. Okay, so yes, and so that is what you call the clinical significance. That means if there's any other, you know, clinical significance, cervical rib communication. Well, yeah, that is what. There are maybe a couple of them, but these are outstanding ones that I like, you know, you to have, you know, seen and heard, and so that when you hear it, see it. Abduction paralysis, plunky paralysis, cervical rib, and phrenic nerve crushing, how it may or may not have the effect. Okay, we have gone there, and now here, axillary lymph nodes. Remember, we are doing the axilla. Remember, we have come, you know, from the upper extremity doing all kinds of things, and then we came to the axilla. And we did the walls of the axilla, you know, base apex walls and everything, and then the contents we did, okay? And so now, in the contents, after doing these axillary lymph nodes, so when we look at the axillary lymph nodes, we will be seeing the axillary lymph nodes. Okay. All right. How did it go? Slip from here. Okay. I'll get this to move. Who is a computer engineer, computer scientist in this class? Any computer scientist? Andrew Simon, any suggestions? Any suggestions for me to get back to my...
Can you exit that screen?
Pardon me?
Can you exit that screen? Like, hide that screen?
Let me see any exit. It's inside. Let me see. Okay. Okay, now let me see if this is good. Is it here right there? Okay, let me just put it in the screen. You can't even see it. Okay, so there's the back. Okay, and let me read. Okay, start fantastic. Okay. So I can call upon you periodically, and I know your name also. So that is good. Andrew Simon. Usually it's Simon Peter, but it's Andrew Simon. Okay. Axillary lymph nodes. Let's go. And by the time this, you know, wakes up, let's go do the axillary lymph nodes here. And that's one of the things. Yeah. Okay, good. The ancillary lymph nodes are good. I always travel with these transparencies to classrooms because anything can happen anytime, and so I can just fall back onto my transparencies. And you have this in the coloring pattern. So let's go and color quickly, and then we can go. All right. So I'm hoping this will come. I'll let it be there. And so here, axillary lymph nodes are labeled according to lymph nodes. What color should they have? Green, purple, red, blue. All right. I have all these. Now, axillary lymph nodes are named according to the walls of the axilla. According to the walls of the axilla. That means according to which wall of the axilla is it draining. And so here we have a lateral group. If it gets in, okay, should I do this one? Oh, okay. No. Yeah, let it come by itself. And so here, first, lateral group. This lateral group here, look at it in blue color. In blue color, I have the lateral group here. That means the lateral wall will be drained by the lateral wall of the axilla. Will be drained by the lateral group, and so here we have, you know, few of them, 3, 4, 5, whatever is the lateral, you know, group there. This lateral group is also draining. That means draining the lymph of the upper extremity also. The lateral group is also draining the upper extremity. Okay, that means it is also called the brachial group, the humeral group, the lateral group. The brachial group, see, computer engineers and computer scientists, we're good. Now we have one who admitted to be one. Others, I know there are others, they don't like to be called on, perhaps. Okay, thanks, Simon. Okay, good. All right, okay, good. And so here, when we look at the lymph nodes here, here we have the lymphatics. And so when you see the mammary gland here, because a lot of the mammary glandular lymph is also draining into the axillary lymph nodes. I will take you through the lymphatic drainage, and the next is the mammary gland. I'll take you through there at that time, but right now, for the time being, so we talk about the axillary lymph nodes that are named according to the walls of the axilla. And so the lateral wall of the axilla, you know what structures are there. And now, in addition to draining the lateral wall of the axilla, the lateral group also drains the upper extremity, okay? So that is there, 4 or 5. And then we have, you know, pectoral group, there are few here by the edge of your pec major muscle. And there is anterior pectoral, medial pectoral, all those, you know, there are a few of them here, you know, anterior pectoral, medial pectoral. So anterior wall of the axilla will be drained by this anterior group. And then we have the medial wall of the axilla will be drained by this medial, you know, pectoral group. And then we have the posterior group, posterior axillary lymph nodes. Posterior axillary lymph nodes are also called sub, there's an S there, subscapular. So which is the major muscle in the posterior wall of the axilla that you have seen the other day? Subscapularis. So that is where this posterior group is also called the subscapular group. So here is the subscapular group. That means it is draining the posterior wall of the axilla. And then we have what is called the central group in red color. Central group right here in red color. And so here is the central group. Now, the central group of the central axillary, you know, nodes are the nodes that you can always feel. You can always feel. They don't have to be enlarged. You can always feel the central group of axillary lymph nodes that is at the base of the axilla. Central group is at the base of the axilla. And so you can see here in the diagram also, central axillary lymph nodes here. Remember, you know, the that's the base. And then we have the other thing is that from the posterior, lateral, anterior, and medial walls of the axilla, lymph will first go to the central group. Lymph will first go to the central group. And so here, you know, we have the central, you know, group right here, okay? From that central group, five or six of them, central. From that central group, they will go to the apical, the apex, remember the apex of the axilla. So they will then go to the apical group. The apical group is here in purple color. Here is the apical group. So that is the apical group right here. And from the apical, so that's the apical group. Apical group may also be referred to as infraclavicular. Apical group is also referred to as infraclavicular. Apical or infraclavicular group. That means it is draining the apex of the axilla. It's draining the apex of the axilla and it's also receiving lymph from the central group. So here you have the central group. And so here you have the apical. Or so subclavian is called infraclavicular, also it is called, and so there it is. From the infraclavicular, it can go to the deep central nodes, or it can go to, you know, to the junction of the right subclavian, if it's the right side, right subclavian and the internal jugular vein. Right subclavian and the internal jugular vein on the right side. On the left side, it will go, you know, to either the thoracic duct or it will go by itself to the junction of the subclavian and the internal jugular vein. The axillary lymph nodes, not only I pay attention to, the general medical practitioners also pay a lot of attention to the lymphatic drainage, especially of the axilla and the mammary glands. Yeah, you have, no, she had a hand up first. Yes.
So, who did you say drained into either the right or the thoracic? Were you talking about?
The apical.
Yeah. The deep cervical, what's that?
What's
that from?
The deep cervical is deep cervical. So there are lots of deep cervical.
So the apical goes into the deep cervical.
Apical.
Apical goes into the deep cervical, the right subclavian, the internal jugular, and the what?
On the right side. On the left side, it will go either to the thoracic duct or to by itself, you know, by lymphatic ducts, you know, to the subclavian duct, it may be called, you know, to the junction of the left internal jugular and the left subclavian.
So apical goes right, left, and deep.
Apical. Yeah. Okay. Somebody else has had a hand up here. Yeah. Mary Alison.
Okay. In the diagram, it looks like the infra-fibular and the apical is in a different area, but you said those are the same.
Yeah. They said what?
It looks like they're targeting a different area, but you said that those are actually the same. They can be called the same thing for the
This one, the infraclavicular?
Yeah.
This is also apical or infraclavicular.
Either or,
infraclavicular. There's also supraclavicular. When we come to the neck, we will do the supraclavicular also, okay? In terms of location. Now, so that is the lymphatic drainage. As you look at it here, you can see, you know, that is, you know, very important because of the drainage of the mammary gland, which, you know, we are going to do, you know, pretty soon. Okay, so the next thing here on the outline is the mammary gland. Why do we do the mammary gland now? The reason is when we look at you know the upper extremity, you've seen its parts. You've seen, you know, it has a shoulder, you know, and it has arm, forearm, you know, hand. And the shoulder you've seen has the parts, you know, the axilla, the pectoral region, and the scapular region. That is why the mammary gland is being damped right now, because, and how is it related to the axilla? Because it is on the anterior wall of the axilla. The pectoral region, okay? And so its location, where is it located? And what type of a gland is it? And that is important. Okay, location, where is it located? It's in the subcutaneous tissue. It's in the subcutaneous tissue. It's anterior to the pec major and the serratus anterior. And sometimes it may also be a little bit over, you know, the external oblique muscle of the abdomen. A little bit of it may spill over, right over onto. Here you have the serratus anterior, pec major, and so you can see interdigitating from, you know, the serratus anterior is the external oblique muscle of the abdomen, you know, and so that is the location. That means, you know, vertically, when you're looking at it, vertically, second rib extends usually from the second to the sixth rib, vertically, in the vertical, you know, position, and horizontally from, you know, what is called, you know, a little bit, you know, to the lateral part of the sternum, you know, so that is, you know, your location. Topography, when you look at the topography of it, it has a, you know, the location and the topography, that what do I mean is, you know, combined, that, you know, the two-thirds of it is over the pec major and one-third is over this and a little bit over, so that is, you know, the topography part. And then structure. As you look at the structure of a mammary gland, so here we have, okay, so here we can look at the mammary gland here. So it is a gland, and what type of gland is it? It's exocrine. Did you say exocrine? Yeah, but in exocrine there are several different types of glands. Sebaceous, exactly. It's a modified sebaceous gland. Fitzpatrick, you have a question.
I'm just trying to find this in Netter. I'm sorry. I'm not sure which section.
Page 177.
Okay.
And, yeah.
Is anterior to which fascia?
I didn't say that. Oh. I didn't say anterior to which fascia. You guys should be telling me that. From your preview, I'm going to ask you questions now. From your preview, you tell me that this is in subcutaneous tissue, it's located in subcutaneous tissue. So what fascia should it be anterior to? Deep fascia, deep fascia, the pectoral fascia. That means the deep fascia over the pectoralis major, you know, muscle. Okay? And so as you look at the structure, you have glandular tissue here in lobules. One lobule, two, two, three, four, like that, lobules, and you have fat. You know, in between the lobules, you have taken history in summer, so you have, you may remember some of this, and you've taken history now, have they come this far? Glands? No? Okay. So glands, so you can see that it has it got a capsule? This is a sebaceous gland, so will it have a capsule? No? Thank you, no. Does it have any fiber sheets surrounding it?
No.
Good. So it has no capsule, it has no fiber sheets surrounding it. It has lobules, about 15 to 20 lobules. Now each of these lobules contain or have a duct. The duct is called the lactiferous duct. The lactiferous duct. So the duct is called lactiferous duct. Okay? So each lobule has a lactiferous duct. So here is that duct coming from each of the lobules and opening into the nipple. Okay? Now in between, you know, remember it is a subcutaneous structure. It's subcutaneous, located subcutaneous, anterior to the pec major muscle. It's not deep to the muscles, anterior. And so, and it has no capsule. So how is it sitting there? How is it, you know, sitting there? There are retinacular cutis or Cooper's ligaments. You might have heard of the Cooper's ligaments. And so here, these structures, this here, this, these are called retinacular cutis. See, from the name, you can figure out what it is doing. Retinacular cutis. What do you understand from that? Structure, I'm on the structure here. Retinacular cutis, what do you think that will be doing? What is a retinacular? What is cutis? It has something to do with what? It has something to do with the skin. It has something to do with the skin. Retinacula. You've seen the retinacula in the angle. What is the retinacula? Thickening, condensation, thickening of the deep fascia. So here we have retinacula cutis or Cooper's ligaments. And so retinacula cutis. What does that tell you? Cutis. To the skin. So it's coming from, you know, the deep fascia there, attaching to the skin. So in between the lobules of the of the gland, we have this retinacula cutis or or here in blue color, I'm going to put here you have, see here, retinacula cutis. See here, here. So the gland is attached to the skin like that, with the retinacula in between. See, there are several. This retinacula cutis here gives you the impression retinacula, you know, what it is made of. Deep fascia and retinacula. And then they're going to the skin. Cutis, retinacular cutis. Or they're also called Cooper's ligaments. Cooper's ligaments. So Cooper's ligaments or retinacular cutis is the same. And why should you know this? Why should a naturopathic physician know about retinacular cutis? Oh, there's breast, mammary gland, breast, female breast, and male breast, and this and that. But what? Why should you know retinacular cutis? If cancer cells affect the retinacular cutis, that means the Cooper's ligaments. space become, these ligaments will become shortened with the effect of the cancer cells going and infiltrating the deep fascia here, the retinacular cutis. These retinacular Cooper's ligaments will become shortened. As a result, what would you see? Fixation. Fixation of that means, you know, parts of, you know, like, yeah, you may see like orange, pink kind of appearance because the retinacula, there are several of them. And so if the skin shortened, retinacula are going to pull on the skin because they have become shortened. And so when you see one of your, you know, patients with, you know, that appearance, then immediately you would think of that, you know, what is happening here, you know, to the retinacular cubis. Hey, this could be very easily the, what is called your, these cancer cells affecting, just hold on, let me complete the sentence, then I'll take the questions, okay. So then this could be the retinacular cubis or the Cooper's ligaments are affected by cancer cells. Okay, so it is not just one little kind of fixation in places. Fixation not of the whole, you know, mammary gland, but in places, you know, little things. Okay, any perspective? Okay, no? Somebody else had a question hand at someplace here. No? Okay. So that is Cooper's ligaments, its clinical significance, where it is, what it is doing, and if I ask you for a short answer, to write, describe the Cooper's ligaments, give the clinical significance or include the clinical significance. You have to give me all this. Hey, you're going to be physicians. You need to know these things. Okay, because breast cancer is, you know, not that uncommon. It is, it happens. You know, it is a, you know, condition that we need to, you know, look at. And so that is, that is the retinacular cubis and, okay, good. Okay, the structure, so you have seen the structure of it, and then the blood supply. We have looked at the blood supply, you know, that means we have talked about one of the blood supplies, or one child that is, you know, giving blood supply, which blood vessel is giving supply, you know, to the mammary gland that you may remember from a previous class? Any artery that comes to mind? Lateral thoracic. Thanks, Michelle. Lateral thoracic, or what else would you call it? Lateral thoracic, or what else would you call it?
External mammary.
Pardon me?
External memory.
Exactly. Lateral thoracic or external memory coming from which artery? Coming from which artery? Lateral thoracic is here.
Axillary
artery. So here is the axilla. There's the axillary artery. So it is coming from the axillary artery. And when we did the axillary artery with its branches, you've seen here, you have the lateral thoracic. So here is the lateral thoracic coming, and you can see it has, you know, branches going. So that is one of them. That you've seen that it is a branch of the axillary artery. And then we also have few others that are, you know, supplying. What is the other one? What is another one? They're supplying the mammary gland.
Internal thoracic
here, let's look at the internal thoracic here. Internal thoracic is a branch of the subclavian artery. So right here is the internal thoracic. Here is the subclavian. Here's the subclavian. Right up to here is the subclavian, becoming the axillary right over here. And from the subclavian, there is an internal thoracic artery coming down. And you can see the branches that are coming from the internal thoracic. Now, when you look at this diagram with the internal thoracic, here you can see the internal thoracic vein and the general thoracic, you know, artery. You can see that perhaps this is this one. Yeah, this one shows internal thoracic here. Here you have it. Internal, here's the subclavian here, internal thoracic artery. So it has its, you know, branches coming there. So internal thoracic, a branch of the subclavian. External thoracic, I mean, external mammary, or you know, lateral thoracic is the branch of the what is called your axillary of the axillary, and then we also have posterior intercostal arteries. Posterior intercostal arteries. Textbook, you know, gives you that idea, that information. The posterior intercostal. Posterior intercostal arteries. I think there are about three or four of them. Arteries, okay? Posterior intercostal arteries. And also, what is called your thoracoepigastric arteries. Thoracoepigastric artery, from the name of it, thoracoepigastric. We have talked about the thoracoepigastric trunk, remember? You know, when we talked about the branches the arteries that are coming for the anastomosis around the scapula. We talked about that. So thoracoepigastric will be a branch of what? Yeah, remember when we talked about the anastomosis around the scapula? There are two branches coming from the subclavian, two coming from the axillary. Okay. Very similarly, what I'm trying to impress upon you is this. The mammary gland is well supplied by, you know, arteries that are branches of both the axillary artery and the subclavian artery. Okay, that is a general bit of information you absolutely must keep in mind. And I also expect you to know the names of internal thoracic. I expect you to know the lateral thoracic, from where they are coming. Posterior intercostal. The reason is when we look at the venous drainage, it's the same named base draining the mammary gland. Must you know that? Yes, you must know the venous drainage and the lymphatic drainage of the mammary gland. I'm very particular about it. The reason is cancer spread. Cancer spread from the mammary gland is via lymphatic drainage, via venous drainage, via physical, you know, physical infiltration. Those are the three ways. And whether you're going to be a cancer specialist or not is immaterial. Whether you're going to be a specialist or not. Generalist, as a general practitioner, you must know these things. Okay, so let's move on. So that's the arterial supply, and then when we look at the blood supply, and then the venous drainage, I will come with the venous spread of the cancer. Now, the lymphatic drainage. When we look at the lymphatic drainage, what do we have here? Lymphatic drainage. The lymphatic drainage of the mammary gland is discussed in two ways, that is cutaneous and parenchymal. Yes, Dr. Thomas. Thank you.
self-critical. Yeah, so she's getting affected. And the birthday is a crony thing. She's such a
power. I went out last night. I got home. I took me in.
When examining is injured in me, that means trauma. Okay. You have to see exactly what is more important is what you call this question. Also, you have immediately, you are not able to function. Yes, and also it can come up. Discs. Okay, those are the three C's. That's orthopedic surgery store. You know, immediately. I was changed by a lot of my foot care basic signs that I learned are, these or NDs. So a whole lot of clinical things I learned during my study.
Thank you. Little darkly colored tissue around the nipple, and so that is the areola.
okay, nipple and the areola. And then we divide this into lateral, superior, medial, and inferior. Okay? And so from the lateral, from my, this line should be a little bit, you know, like that, a little bit like that. So from cutaneous, you know, component, cutaneous part of, you know, this part of the mammary gland, this part of the mammary gland, where is it going? From the lateral part of the mammary gland, it is going to the anterior pectoral, you know, lymph nodes, anterior pectoral. Here you can see, remember when we talked about the lymph nodes here in this region, there is anterior medial, you know, pectoral or axillary nodes. So from this part it is going to the anterior, you know, pectoral, you know, axillary lymph or axillary lymph nodes. And from the superior part here, like from this part here, see, as you look at it here like that, you know, from the superior part it goes to the medial nodes and or the apical and or the epital. So here you can see the superior part here is going to, some of them would go to the medial, intermediate, you know, right here, and then also it will go to the apical. See, remember the apical? And so Katie likes to say apical. And so, so here is the epical. And so we will keep that name for her, okay? And so that means, so that is from here. So lateral part, superior part, and medial part right here. This part, medial part. Listen to the medial part. Intermammary or in or parasternal. Internal mammary or parasternal. Let me write that here. Internal mammary, internal mammary or parasternal or parasternal nodes, parasternal lymph nodes, okay? These are internal mammary, that means internal mammary or parasternal is just right along here. See here? Internal mammary or parasternal nodes, parasternal here, parasternal nodes, and parasternal nodes, and look at this. This is very important. Look at this. Here, they also go to the cutaneous lymphatic drainage of the opposite breast. Of the opposite breast. Here is the fatty tissue of the opposite breast. And here, it is going, you know, to the cutaneous drainage. So it, there is continuity between the right and the left mammary glands, lymphatic, lymph vessels, lymphatic drainage, there's continuity. So lymph can go from here to here. Yeah.
So it flows right to left?
Left to right, right to left, whichever. That's either way. Either way it is. Either way it is. Okay. And so since this happened to be that, you know, the right breast, I was just using that as an example. So it can go to the parasternal or internal mammary nodes that are here. Okay? And in addition, then from the inferior part, like from this part, inferior part right here, inferior part, see, look at these, inferior part right here, it goes to the cutaneous, that means it has connection, communication with the cutaneous lymphatic, you know, drainage of the anterior abdominal wall. And to the phrenic nodes, and to the nodes of the liver, nodes of the liver, to the nodes of the liver. Now, this is you know, liver and phrenic means subdiaphragmatic or phrenic. You may see the textbook saying phrenic or sub phrenic or sub diaphragm, okay? that is pragmatic noise. Okay, so you can see cutaneous lymphatic drainage from this part. You can see they've shown some of the lymph vessels. You can see coming down, some of them coming down, some of them, you know, going like that. So cutaneous drainage, lymphatic drainage from the breast, the mammary gland, is going into all these areas, not only to the axillary lymph nodes, but also to, you know, the opposite breast, and also to the abdominal nerves and the liver. Liver, because when you look at the liver, when you look at the diaphragm, subdiaphragmatic, on the undersurface of the diaphragm, there is, you know, communication between the liver, lymph vessels, and this diaphragmatic. When you see that, you will see the liver has a bare area. It has no peritoneum covering there. There's bare area of the liver, and you know the diaphragm is sitting right there, and so there is, you know, lymphatic, you know, connection. And so, and that is, and then when we look at, that is the cutaneous. This is what we were talking about, you know, was the cutaneous. And then we have the parenchymal. That means the parenchymal lymphatic drainage from the tissue proper. Now, when we talked about the cutaneous, I forgot to tell you something, and I'm going to put now. The skin is not this man. That means this area, the areola, and the nipple is not drained, you know, via the cutaneous, you know, lymphatic drainage. And cutaneous, you know, lymphatic drainage is radiating via what is called a circumareolar plexus of lymph vessels. Circumareolar plexus of lymph vessels. More, your textbook talks about this. They do talk about areola, they do talk about parenchymal and which part is going into and all those things. But they don't do a systematic, you know, thing like that where you can really absorb it, you know, so easily. That's why I take you through this, because I want you to know this very nicely, systematically in your head, and so you will not forget. Now, when we talk about the cutaneous innervation, I did not include, and I'm not talking about the nipple and the areola. The nipple and the areola was not drained by the circumareolar plexus of lymph vessels that are draining all the circumareola, okay, around, you know, here, from around this here. So where will the skin, that means the areola, the colored part, and the nipple, you know, lymphatic drainage, where will that go? It will go with the parenchyma. It will go with the parenchyma, the tissue proper. So they show that here. So the textbook talks about that too. And so here, see here, they see this plexus here? This plexus is this one here. Circumareolar plexus of lymph vessels. Circumareolar plexus of lymph vessels. That is the cutaneous drainage. And then we have the parenchymal. The parenchymal, you know, drainage. When we look at the parenchymal drainage, that lymph includes the nipple and the areola. That means it is drained via what is called a subareolar plexus. This is circumareolar. Okay? The other one is subareolar. So for the parenchyma, you have the subareolar plexus of lymph vessels. Okay? Sape or subareolar plexus of lymph vessels is, you know, draining the parenchyma and the skin of the areola and the nipple. And where do they go? To the anterior axillary nodes. To the anterior axillary nodes here. Anterior axillary nodes, you have anterior axillary nodes, so that means from here, you know, it will be going to the anterior axillary nodes. And also, what's really very important is that this subareolar plexus, sapi, also communicates with the deep fascia of the lymphatics of the deep fascia. That means the deep fascia that is anterior to the pec major muscle, the deep fascia. That is the basis. That is the basis on which, when somebody has to have radical mastectomy, the doctors will go and remove the deep fascia anterior to the pec major muscle, and they may even, you know, remove part of the pec major if they have to, depending upon what is the involvement, depending upon what is the involvement. Now, so, yes.
They remove
three hands went, I saw 1, 2, 3. So my peripheral vision is good, yeah, okay.
What did you say, they remove the deep lymph nodes?
No, radical, let me write it down. When I say the radical mastectomy, lumpectomy is different only if there's a lump, they remove the lump, okay? And then radical mastectomy means they remove the whole breast tissue along with some deeper structures. That's radical mastectomy, okay? And in which case? In case of radical mastectomy, they will remove the deep fascia, you know, deep to the mammary gland, and also even part of, if it is involved, even part of the pec major, you know, muscles. So, and if the axillary lymph nodes, those axillary, radical means the regional lymph nodes that are involved will also be removed, okay? Because anterior axillary nodes or any of the axillary nodes that are involved will be removed. Okay, so that is what's called radical. It's a radical change. Okay? And so radical mastectomy means it includes a whole lot of structures that have to be removed. Now, and so the deep, that means the lymphatics of the sapi is draining, and sapi has connection, that means communication with, you know, the lymphatics of the deeper, you know, structures. Alright? And so then, I like to take you from here, that is, the best way is some clinical significance. I have done that, and let me okay, here. Prognosis in cancer of the breast based on lymphatic drainage and then the venous spread. Okay, let's go through prognosis in cancer of the breast based on lymphatic drainage. Alright, so here, let's have this mammary gland here.
Dr. Thomas?
Yes.
Wait,
yeah, I need to listen now, okay, yeah.
Would I be correct to assume that all these same structures are in men as well?
All these structures must
are in men as well.
In men?
She wants to know if these structures are in men.
Men?
Or which males. These structures are in men, are in males.
In male. I didn't hear the male. Man, I thought I heard. I thought, what man is she talking about? All of a sudden, I didn't hear. I didn't switch. I couldn't switch fast enough to hear man. Man, and I didn't know man. Anyway, so, okay. Male mammary gland. Male mammary gland has the glandular structure, but very rudimentary form, very rudimentary. That means it's not grown. Okay, it's not grown. Okay, but males can also have male mammary glands can also develop cancer. 1.5%, 1.5% of males in North America develop what you call cancer of the breast, and they do have a rudimentary form of of mammary glands or tissue, but it is not lactating. And but it can, the rudimentary form can become active if there is, you know, some abnormal thing is going on, you know. Okay, growing children, you know, like pre-pubescent period, 12, 13, 14, somewhere there, you know, they may sometimes have a little bit of engorged kind of, you know, mammary gland, then that subsides. That subsides, and then it becomes, you know, just the rudimentary form. And the same thing, here, what's the thing here? Here. Why I included this milk line here, because in previous editions of More, this was not there. So I used to include this for my students, okay? So I still have it in the packet, even though this is in the textbook now. In the newer edition of More, he has more, a lot of these things now that I used to include, you know, before when he didn't have it. So then when you look at, I'm going away, but I like to include this. This is in the textbook, 198, 200 something pages there. And this is called the milk line. Milk line. And in this milk line here, you can see that it may be supernumerary, you know, what do you call nipples and mammary glands, okay? And so they are along here, and they may be like rudimentary. They may be like rudimentary. They don't secrete, but they are, some of them are capable of it. There is any abnormality, you know, taking place. Otherwise, many times, a lot of people have a few like this along the line, right up to here, and this, sometimes people think they are moles, something like that, because there's no tissue, you know, involved there. So this is like the animal kingdom, you know, the animals going like that, if they have, you know, breasts all over. So just like that. So, you know, cats and dogs, you know how many they have. You know, so like that. Like that, we also have the milk line here. Humans also have the milk line here. Okay, we don't see it because we don't have supernumerary little dots there. But if you see little dots on your patients, don't be alarmed. All right, let's move on to. Okay, now where am I going? So here, prognosis in cancer of the breast based upon lymphatic drainage. All right, that's very important. Okay, now parenchyma we have gone over. Let's bring this quadrant. This quadrant is also given by Dr. Moore in 198, page 198 or somewhere there. He has given the quadrants, and I was very pleased to see when he brought that on. So right here. Okay, like that. And so here, when you look at it, and so he gives, you know, it like that, okay, so I'm going to give it like that. So I have the four, you know, quadrants like that. Now, from the upper quadrant, let me go here, let me draw it. I think his quadrants are better, so I'm going to take his quadrants here. Yeah, his quadrants are better. Okay, he's retired, but and so here, when and so when you look at it here, this is the upper outer quadrant of the breast. Upper outer quadrant of this is the right breast. Okay, yeah, the right breast. So this is the right mammary gland, and so upper outer quadrant. If one develops cancer in the upper outer quadrant, the prognosis is most favorable. Is most favorable because lymphatic drainage from here is going only into the axillary lymph nodes. So this is the most favorable place if one has to have most favorable quadrant. Okay, and then if one develops cancer in this lower, outer, lower quadrant, this is outer, lower quadrant, less favorable. That means a little bit more, you know, involved, less favorable. That means, remember, some of these go into the anterior abdominal wall deals. And then, if it develops here, upper, inner, you know, quadrant, upper, inner quadrant, if we have cancer in the upper, inner quadrant, that is dangerous. This quadrant, it is dangerous. Okay? It is dangerous because of its proximity to the other breast and the mediastinum, and the mediastinum. We haven't studied the mediastinum yet, okay? So we will be studying the mediastinum. This is how you spell that, mediastinum, okay? Remember, in the mediastinum, we have the heart, you know, pericardium, heart, and everything, and on the sides of the mediastinum, you have the lungs, okay? So mediastinum, serous fluid, serous membrane, pericardial sac. So the proximity to the mediastinum, this is the inner, upper inner quadrant is dangerous because of its proximity to to the mediastinum, and you know, to the opposite, you know, mammary gland. Okay, the most dangerous should be put in two or three colors, maybe. Most dangerous is this quadrant. Most dangerous, based on the lymphatics. So most dangerous is the lower inner quadrant because of the proximity to the peritoneum. Peritoneum, we haven't done it yet. Peritoneum, as you may remember, is peritoneal cavity. So yeah, that means to the peritoneum, that is most dangerous. And also, you remember from this lower, you know, quadrant, you know, here, peritoneum, you know, covers the entire abdominal viscera, surrounds it, and it goes, it has folds and everything, and things can grow in the peritoneal cavity. Peritoneal cavity is very minute, you know, cavity there, you know, what is called, it is not, you know, considered to be an anatomical space, but it has enough fluid, so things can grow there very easily and game over. Because something gets into the peritoneal cavity, peritonitis, and a whole lot of things. So therefore, so the most dangerous, why do I go over this? The reason why I go over this is because your patients may be diagnosed with one of these conditions, and he or she may come and ask you, what are my chances? So you look at the prognosis. You know the prognosis, I'll come to you in a minute. You look at the prognosis and you have all the test results and everything, then you know anatomical, you know, prognosis based on this, then you can give some, you know, answers, you know. Answer, yeah, of course.
What would be responsible for the metastasis to the mediastinum? Would it be like a structural invasion or a serous tumor?
What would be the basis of the metastasis to the mediastinum? Now we are talking about the vehicle as the lymph. As the lymph right now. Lymph right now, okay? Lymphatic drainage, because remember, in the mediastinum, when we talked about those lymph vessels, the subdiaphragmatic, and the subdiaphragmatic diaphragm sitting there, you know, there is that area, and also there is, you know, several, you know, structures. There are lots of lymph nodes in the thorax, like right against the, what do you call the backbone, you know, the vertebrae, the vertebral column, you have, you know, the thoracic duct there and lots of lymph nodes and lymph vessels. And the connection and communication there, then it can get, you know, to several, you know, lymph nodes. That is the reason. And so then, so that is based on the lymphatics, okay? Prognosis based on the lymphatics. And then when we look at the prognosis, based on the venous drainage. On the venous drainage, and so here, venous spread of cancer of the breast. And so you may remember that we had this one here, the venous drainage. Let's look at the venous drainage here. What is called your lateral thoracic vein going right into the axillary vein. Lateral thoracic vein going right into the axillary vein. And so here you can see this, where the lateral thoracic artery was supplying, that means from all these areas. And then you also have the internal thoracic vein traveling right alongside the internal thoracic artery going right into the subclavian. You know, vein there. And then you have the intercostal, posterior intercostal, let me see the intercostals someplace here. Posterior intercostals and anterior intercostals we have. But here we talk about the posterior intercostals. Posterior intercostals are, here it shows you some of them. You know, here it shows you, you know, the internal thoracic, and you can see some of the intercostals are there, but they are not posterior intercostals. So what it is here. Open up. Okay, as you come here, your question. So here, this is what we are calling the mediastinum. Okay. So here you can see how when something gets into one of these lymph vessels, lymph nodes, how it can go all the way into the lymphatic system. In addition to that, when we look at this one here, here we have the posterior intercostal veins here. See? Posterior intercostal veins. Okay? So, the posterior intercostal veins are draining part of the mammary gland. The internal thoracic veins draining part of the mammary gland. The lateral thoracic vein is draining part of the mammary gland. And the thoracoepigastric vein is also draining part of. Now, how can cancer spread to different structures via this venous system? As you look at it here, the posterior intercostal veins, that is draining part of the mammary gland. Where are they draining into? They're draining into what is called the azygous system of veins, the azygous system of veins. We will study the azygous system of veins in the second quarter. Okay. And so, azygous system of veins, and the azygous system has also connection with, as you can see, azygous system will also have connection with the, because it's originating from back of the inferior vena cava, and so vena cava is going right posterior to the liver right here, and so there is connection with the liver, and the azygous system has communication with the vertebral venous plexus. And so what you see is that, okay, so this one stays. Vertebral, if somebody didn't get that word, vertebral. Vertebral, venous, plexus. So the vertebral venous plexus. And now you can see cancer of the breast, by venous spread, how can it get to the vertebrae? To the bone, to the vertebrae. Because the posterior intercostal veins are draining part of the lymphatics, part of the mammary gland. and the posterior intercostals are draining into the esophagus, and the posterior intercostals also have direct communication with the vertebral venous plexus. Vertebral venous plexus is draining the vertebral bodies, the vertebrae, spinal cord and whatnot. Okay? And then, internal thoracic. Here, or the internal thoracic. Here you have the internal thoracic piece, right here. This side, the internal thoracic going up, right, superior intercostal. That's the intercostal. So internal thoracic should be okay. That's not right over here. Internal thoracic goes into the subclavian here. Okay? And look at the right and the left subclavian. And this, of course, is the brachiocephalic vein on the right one here, left one. But right subclavian, left subclavian, where do they go? They go into the superior vena cava. Internal thoracic going into the subclavian. Subclavian going into the brachiocephalic. But I'm just not going to take you through the entire route. Subclavian, superior vena cava. Where is the superior vena cava going to go into the heart? From the heart, it's just not staying there too much, isn't it? The cardiac cycle, pumping, going to the lungs. So going to the lungs. In the lungs, the venous blood is staying there a little bit for cleansing. Remember your oxygen, whatever else, chloride, shift, whatever else. And so it's staying there a little bit. So it can spread. Mammary gland, but cancer of the breast can also spread to the lungs via venous drainage. That means via the axillary to the superior vena cava to the lungs. Of course, you know, through the heart and everything, but through the lungs. So it can spread to the vertebral bodies or the vertebrae, to the lungs, and it can spread to the liver. Yes, it can spread to the liver because you know you have this type of, you know, venous, you know, spread. And where else, you know, can it, you know, spread to? It can spread to the, let me see. Okay, that's about, you know, the vertebrae. And if it is into the vertebral venous plexus, it can ultimately go to the cranial cavity. Because the vertebral venous plexus drains the vertebrae and is in the vertebral canal, and so there is communication up and down. Communication, venous communication through the cranial cavity. So this is how, when you say somebody had breast cancer 5 years ago, and now after 3 years, I'll come to you, Ria. She now begins to have backache. Immediately you should think, somebody who has had breast cancer, say 2 years ago, and she had treatments and everything, and she was fine. But now she's complaining backache to you. You as a trained physician must know that it is possible. That it is possible that it is spreading to the vertebral bodies. That it is spreading to the vertebrae. That's where the person has backache. Okay, you want to think of like that. Think of things like that. Okay? And you know, lungs and other places, you know, you can see coughing and this and that. And something comes, it's not healing, and you may want to think, is it? Is it, you know? And so, Priya, you had a question.
When cancer is spreading to these different places through the blood, is it...
Through the venous blood.
The venous blood.
Yeah.
Is it cancerous cells floating in the blood, or are they growing along the actual vascular tissue?
Cancer cells, her question was, when you say spread of cancer via the venous blood, is it floating along? Cells are floating along in the blood, or it is?
Or is it growing along the tissue of the vessels?
Or is it going along the tissue of the vessels? I would say it is floating along. I would say it is floating along, but not for long, you know, distances. Because cancer cells, you know, one of the things is that, you know, they are able to attach. They're able to attach, you know, to anything that is in the blood. That means, you know, if you have a platelet accumulation, you know, platelets floating and all that, if there's a platelet accumulation, you know, and if the blood, so then, you know, these cells can snoop around to see what's happening.
So
okay.
I mean, if you had cancer in the mammary gland, it would be able to get to lower extremities?
That is, yeah, if there is cancer of the, cancer in the mammary gland, when it gets to the lower extremity, it's unusual. It's unusual for it to get to the lower extremity. Yeah, it is usually not. The only thing I would say is that perhaps to the bone, you know, from the vertebrae, that means the sacrum, you know, that means from there, perhaps you could get to the femur. But that takes a long while. But not, you know, to the other, you know, parts that I know of. From my readings, I haven't. Okay, you guys, and so the cancer anatomic basis of feet. And I have time also for just one thing, that is anatomical basis of signs of cancer. Anatomical basis of, because that is a nice, you know, little packet to finish where, you know, and anatomical basis of signs of cancer, that is the next thing. And what is the first sign, anatomical basis of lung, anatomical basis of physical signs of cancer, okay? And so, what is the first sign, anatomical sign that you would find if somebody has developed, you know, cancer of the breast? I mean, not blood test is not anatomical sign. What is it? Lump. Lump, presence of lump is an early sign. Presence of lump in the breast tissue is an early sign. And fixation or depression of the skin, little later sign, and that is from affecting the fibroceptor or the Cooper's ligament, natural cubis, okay? And little later than that, inversion, I-N-V-E-R-S-I-O-N, inversion of the nipples from lactiferous duct. Inversion of the nipples when cancer cells affect the lactiferous duct. Inversion of the nipples from cancer cells affecting the lactiferous ducts, okay? So, inversion of the nipples, that means in that person, you know, cancer cells have affected the lactiferous ducts. You know, remember the ducts come and open into the nipples, and so if those ducts are affected, then they pull down on the nipples. And the much later stage is fixation of the whole gland. The gland, you know, is not movable. Fixation of the whole gland. That means cancer cells invading the deep fascia, the pectoral fascia. You know, that means the fascia in front of the pectoralis major muscle. And that is the later stage, fixation of the whole gland. And so that is the the anatomical basis, you know, and the stages. But you can have blood tests early, this and that, and all kinds of things. And so the next thing I will be doing is the shoulder joint, because you guys need, there are several big muscles associated with this region. That means muscles with attachment to the scapula and the shoulder joint. Scapula and shoulder joint, there are several muscles, but they are huge, big muscles, and you are well versed by looking at the muscle tables now to get the required information. So I'll do the shoulder joint, and we'll be done with this on Thursday. And I'll go to the arm, forearm, hand one, after doing this one. All right, okay. I have to close up here. Okay, I can't spend the 10 minutes right here. As I'm closing up, you can talk to me, or you can come to the office. I have to be home at 4:30. Okay. I can't.